Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. The UN Rights Office, OHCHR, and the UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, on Thursday called on Myanmar's neighbours to offer shelter to all those fleeing violence and persecution amid ongoing strife linked to the 1st of February coup. The appeal comes as the Myanmar crisis enters its third month, with additional concerns raised about renewed fighting between state armed forces and ethnic armed groups in border areas, which have driven people to flee. According to the UN Rights Office, OHCHR, at least 510 peaceful protesters have been killed by the security forces, and more than 2,600 are in detention, including many held incommunicado or forcibly disappeared. Night raids, mass arrests, and killings have become daily occurrences throughout the country, the OHCHR Southeast Asia Regional Office said in a news release. 10 days after armed groups carried out a deadly attack on three villages near the western Niger town of Tilia, UN humanitarians have repeated their call for greater protection of civilians and all those displaced by violence in the Sahel. The UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, reported on Thursday that six refugees from nearby Mali were among the 137 people who were killed on the 21st of March by assailants on motorbikes. Most of the victims had already fled violence in 2020, UNHCR said, adding that 1,400 survivors from the targeted villages are now on the move and many are in shock and mourning. Highlighting the vulnerability of civilians in the region and the urgency of their situation, Gillian Triggs, UNHCR's Assistant High Commissioner for Protection, encouraged efforts to address the growing insecurity, noting that it was clear that the attacks on displaced people and communities hosting them were targeted and deliberate. In addition to the unjustifiable violence meted out against civilians, shelters and granaries were also burned to the ground. Cattle were stolen or killed. Survivors have nothing left, Ms. Triggs said. Niger, Burkina Faso and Mali in the Sahel are at the center of one of the world's fastest growing displacement and protection crises. The region now hosts nearly 3 million refugees and people displaced inside their own country. Finally, to Rwanda, where it's been 27 years since more than 1 million people were systematically murdered in less than 3 months there. In comments marking the International Day of Reflection on the 1994 genocide, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres urged all people to join in solidarity with the African nation and to take a hard look at today's world to ensure that the events of 1994 are not forgotten. All around the world, people now face pressure and manipulation from extremists to join their ranks, Mr. Guterres said, describing the hardline groups as the principal security threat in many countries. The UN chief condemned their vile messages that are now transmitted on social media platforms, as well as the misinformation and hate speech that are used to stoke violence. Despite their divisive threat, there is hope, the Secretary General insisted, describing Rwanda's progress since overwhelmingly Tutsi victims were murdered, along with many Hutus and others who opposed the genocide.
Rwanda experienced one of the most painful chapters in modern human history, but its people have rebuilt from the ashes. After suffering unspeakable gender-based violence and discrimination, Rwanda's women now hold more than 60% of parliamentary seats, making Rwanda a world leader. The people of Rwanda have shown us the power of justice and reconciliation and the possibility of progress. On this solemn day, let us all commit to building a world guided by human rights and dignity for all.
To prevent history from repeating itself, the UN chief called on people to resist these hate-driven movements and to redouble their efforts to defend the rights of all members of society. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, to celebrate the publishing of Michael Ratner's autobiography, we speak with several people who knew him well.
Michael Ratner's long-awaited memoir, Moving the Bar, My Life as a Radical Lawyer, has now come out. Michael was a founder of our show. Today, Chris Hedges interviews me about Michael's life. We also speak with his friend Eleanor Stein about Michael in law school, Richard Levy, who litigated cases with Michael, and David Cole, his mentee.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. Michael Ratner's autobiography called Moving the Bar is now available for all to read. Michael Smith, why is the autobiography coming out now, 5 years after Michael passed away?
Well, Michael started the book, and then he set it aside for other pressing matters. And then when he was diagnosed with cancer, he knew he was running out of time. He picked up the manuscript again, and he tried to finish it, but he didn't quite make it. So Karen Rinucci, his widow, hired Zach Sklar, the author, and Zach finished the book for Michael. That's why it's been 5 years in the making. But Zach was able to use prior interviews, articles, new interviews with friends and family. And when he completed the book, it's really seamless. It's done in Michael's tone of voice, and it's beautifully written. It's a very moving book. Moving the Bar, My Life as a Radical Lawyer. And people can get it now at Orr Books.
Now, Michael, we've done several really insightful interviews with people who knew Michael Ratner closely. Chris Hedges, Eleanor Stein, Richard Levy, David Cole, all luminaries in their own right.
Chris's career crisscrossed with Michael, as he talks about in the interview that he did with me. Eleanor Stein went to law school with him and talks about how he became a radical. Richard Levy litigated many cases with Michael. And David Cole was Michael's mentee when he worked at the Center for Constitutional Rights. David Cole is now the litigation director at the ACLU. So these people tell the story of Michael in the most beautiful way, and that's what we're going to play today. First, let's hear from Chris Hedges, interviewing me, Michael Smith, on his program, On Contact.
Welcome to On Contact. Today we discuss the legacy of the radical civil rights attorney, Michael Ratner, with his close collaborator and friend, Michael Smith.
Michael took what seemed to be a hopeless case, and he lost. He went up to the Court of Appeals, and he lost. He went up to the Supreme Court, and they won. And he, along with a team of 600 lawyers that he had organized to defend the Bill of Rights, went on to litigate those cases, and they eventually freed. They forced Bush to free over 500 of these prisoners, and they stopped Bush from torturing these men. So I think that amongst the many, many great cases that Michael handled or initiated, that was probably the foremost case.
Michael Ratner was one of the most important civil rights attorneys of our era. He spent his life fighting on behalf of those the state and the empire sought to crush. From the leaders of the prison uprising at Attica to Muslim prisoners held in Guantanamo to Julian Assange. First in his class at Columbia Law School, he could have easily slipped into the lucrative world of corporate law. But Michael wanted something more than money and status out of life. He wanted to make a difference. He wanted to make the world a better place. Michael, who died in 2016, was the president of the National Lawyers Guild. He spent 40 years at the Center for Constitutional Rights, first as a staff attorney, then litigation director, and finally as president. He helped establish the European Center for Human and Constitutional Rights and the Palestine Legal Fund to defend supporters of the Palestinian people against what he called the Palestine exception to the First Amendment. In 2004, he started the radio show Law and Disorder on WBAI with other attorneys, including Michael Smith, and it is now broadcast nationally on 120 stations. As a lawyer, often working pro bono, he won historic legal victories, such as protecting Haitians infected with the HIV virus who were initially confined by the U.S. at its military base in Guantanamo, Cuba. He initiated and organized some 600 lawyers and firms large and small across the country to come to the defense of Muslim prisoners accused of terrorism and held at Guantanamo after 9/11. He took the case to the Supreme Court and won for these prisoners the basic right of habeas corpus. He was, as Vladimir Lenin wrote, as radical as reality itself. He understood that those who are above the struggle are also beside the point. He had four key principles of being a radical lawyer. Do not refuse to take a case just because it has long odds of winning in court. Use cases to publicize a radical critique of U.S. policy and to promote revolutionary transformation. Combine legal work with political advocacy. And finally, love people. Joining me to discuss Michael Ratner's recently published memoir, Moving the Bar, My life as a radical lawyer is his close friend and collaborator for nearly three decades, the attorney Michael Smith. So I want you, Michael, as an attorney who has been long in this struggle, to set the stage for us, because I think reading Michael's book, you get a sense that it's almost a rear guard action, that there was a period, certainly right after the 1960s, the late 60s, early 70s, when the courts were a positive force for social change. But then there was this steady deterioration. I think in his book, Michael talks about the Patriot Act. He actually calls it a coup d'etat. But talk about that trajectory that really dominates your work as an attorney and Michael Ratner's work as an attorney.
Well, I think that Michael viewed the degradation and decline of democracy as something that's gone on since Ronald Reagan, really, over the last 40 years. Michael thought that democracy was not compatible, ultimately, with capitalism. He thought fascism was, but not democracy. And in the course of his almost 50 years of litigating, he saw that that decline and resisted it. Resisted it 40 years ago with his litigation around Central America. When the Nicaraguans rose up and overthrew Somoza, the dictator, Somoza was a second-generation dictator. His father had been the dictator in the 30s. Roosevelt called Somoza a bastard, but he's our bastard. His kid came to power, was overthrown by the Nicaraguans who tried to control their own country and their own lives, and an organization called the Contras was established to overthrow the Nicaraguan Revolution. Reagan called them the George Washington of his times. And Michael began litigating what was an illegal war in financing the Contras. That was 40 years ago. And so I think that you make the point that it's been a rearguard action, actually, since then. Michael didn't live to see the consequences of Trump, but Trump is really a reflection of that, isn't he?
Yes. I was in Central America then. It's so funny how many times Michael's lives, work and life converged with my own. Of course, later I was in the Middle East, and then I flew to London with Michael to meet Julian Assange. Michael was going almost every month to London as Assange's lead attorney in the United States. Let's talk about the deterioration of law, which Michael talks about in his book. Let's kind of lay out for people what has happened to diminish our democracy and diminish our rights as citizens over the last few decades. I know not just going even before the Authorization to Use Military Force Act in 2002, I believe that was that the right year. But going back even to the misuse of grand juries, talk about how the judiciary, and I think one of the points Michael makes in the book, that it's really the legal system that makes significant change. It's never the elected politicians who are too cautious. So it was the judiciary was kind of the last readout. And talk about that process, you know, the legal decisions that have diminished the judiciary as an effective force for our own rights and our own protection.
Well, Michael saw law as a method of social control created by a socioeconomic system that was determined at all costs to perpetuate itself by any means necessary and for as long as possible. So he understood the rule of law. Now, there are exceptions. The Bill of Rights is an exception. The American Constitution did not contain the Bill of Rights initially, and it was only the small shopkeepers and farmers, the people who actually made the revolution, that would not support the Constitution until they put in a Bill of Rights. So there's a contradiction between capitalist law and the Bill of Rights, and it was in that area, that contradiction, that Michael worked. He started off, well, let me just begin with with some background for Michael, because I think it's important for our viewers to understand that Michael came from an immigrant family in Cleveland. His father came from Poland, Bialystok, Poland, at age 20. He was 5'4" tall. He didn't speak English. He spoke Yiddish. He married a woman from an extremely poor family, Ann Spott. She was the 11th of 12 children who grew up during the Depression in Cleveland. And that's how they started out. When Michael was born, Yiddish was his first language. His parents had to send him to school to learn how to articulate English. The parents were attached really to the old country, and many of their relatives were killed during the Holocaust. So Michael remembers as a young child, men at his father developed into a successful businessman. He started off literally carrying water on a construction site, and he became the head of a company that sold building supplies. And he hired black people, and he hired refugees from the deportation camps, Jews with numbers on their forearms. His mother took Michael and his younger brother Bruce around looking for apartments so they could help resettle these refugees from Poland. So Michael saw that terrible consequence of the Second World War, and he grew up with that consciousness. And the thing I think that turned him into what he became was his experiences in 1968. And I think it's important to understand for our listeners who are younger than we are that 1968 was a crucial year in world history in many respects. The Vietnamese Revolution was unfolding. The United States was trying to stop it unsuccessfully. The Civil Rights Movement was unfolding. There were huge uprisings in 67. King was killed then. The French workers and students almost made a revolution. De Gaulle, who was the head of France, left the country. If it wasn't for the reformism and hesitancy of the Communist Party, we would have had a socialist France. The undemocratic Stalinist dictatorship in Czechoslovakia was almost overthrown. So the world was in upheaval. Michael took a year off of Columbia Law School and went down to Baltimore to work for the NAACP and the Civil Rights Movement. And he came back to Columbia Law School on the very day that the students had occupied several buildings on the campus. Michael showed up, the cops raided these buildings, brutalized the students, 700 students were sent to the hospital. Michael was grabbed and beaten down to the ground and badly hurt. And I think that's what changed Michael. That was the crucial point, because he understood the role that Columbia was playing. They had tried to build a gym on a park in Harlem, and they put up a separate door in the back for black people. They had an institution that helped theoretical studies on the war in Vietnam and do mathematics. They were connected to the whole imperial system. And Michael thought about what his uncle had told him, don't work for somebody else. But Michael decided he would work for somebody else, but that somebody else wouldn't be a private corporation in a white shoe law firm, that somebody else would be the movement. And when he graduated 2 years later, he went and got a job with Constance Bakely Marker, who was the only black federal judge in the country. When he got out of that job, he started a private law practice with Margaret Ratner, who became his wife. And then in 1971, he was asked to work at the Center for Constitutional Rights. The center had come out of the civil rights movement. The three leaders of the center were the great lawyers at that time for the civil rights movement. Bill Kunstler, of course, our listeners will remember, but also Morton Stavis and Arthur Conoy. And they had a little loft in the pornography district on 42nd Street, little walk-up, the one room, there were about 12 people in the room. And instead of joining a law firm that was real fancy with suites, Michael joined this one-room loft in the porno district on 42nd Street. 3 days later, they sent them to Attica. It was the first day that outsiders were allowed to come in to Attica. And Michael's job was to interview the prisoners on what happened. It was a massacre. Governor Rockefeller had his eyes on becoming president. He didn't want to see his opponents talking about him as being soft on the rebellion. The prisoners had rose up for good reason in this overcrowded medieval fortress just south of Buffalo, and they had taken over the prison. And Rockefeller called in the troops, and they gunned down people in the D yard. They killed 37 people. And Michael went up there to find out what happened. That was his first assignment from the center. He was a staff attorney there. He became the litigation director. Then he became the president of the Center for Constitutional Rights. He stayed there for 40 years. And that's something that we could talk about, the various cases that he handled when he was part of the center.
Great. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation about Michael Ratner's new memoir with the attorney Michael Smith. Welcome back to On Contact. We continue our conversation about Michael Ratner's new memoir, Raising the Bar, with the attorney Michael Smith. I want to go back, Michael, to his work with Judge Motley. He writes in the book, but the appeals court very often reversed Judge Motley's decisions, and her courthouse critics gossiped that Judge Motley was, quote-unquote, not that smart, referring to a woman who had argued 10 cases in the Supreme Court and won 9 of them. No appeals court judge had a record close to that. Not that smart, Ratner writes, simply meant that the conservative, business-oriented appeals court did not agree with decisions she had based, at least in part, on elementary fairness or equal treatment before the law. I have often thought about this question of who is quote-unquote smart. Somehow conventional legal pundits consider Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts quote-unquote very smart. He can upend court precedent by narrowly reading earlier decisions that established fundamental protections. He can find all the ambiguities in those cases and can color key facts in his own way. He can reach a decision that appears logical but is simply a scholastic exercise masquerading as a judicial opinion. However, when a woman and or a black judge reads cases to establish rights broadly and interject fairness into a decision, the legal pundits label that judge not smart. And I think what he's really saying here is how those who take a broader sense of the law, as he did and as you do, a broader understanding of the law, are dismissed by the conservative hierarchy. Can you just talk about, I thought that was a really interesting point.
Michael was very sensitive to the decline of democracy. And when he saw the planes hit the Twin Towers, he was down there. He was jogging past those Twin Towers when the planes hit. He knew that the world was going to be a qualitatively different place. Then the war was ginned up against Afghanistan, and then, of course, against Iraq on a false pretense that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction and was an ally of Osama bin Laden. And then the military order number one, the authorization for the use of force, were both passed along with the Patriot Act. And that's what spurred Michael into action. The military order number one set up Guantanamo. Guantanamo was an offshore prison island. The government had schemed to set up a place where prisoners had no rights. They weren't prisoners of war. They were detainees. They weren't criminals. They were detainees. And as such, they had no rights as prisoners of war or of criminals. And Michael brought a lawsuit. He was totally alone. He had to convince the CCR to go along with it. Michael brought a lawsuit to aim to get those Muslim prisoners in this offshore prison camp on Guantanamo to get them the right of habeas corpus, which means literally produce the body. Under our law, if you're arrested, they have to tell you why they arrested you, and they have to bring you in front of a judge. And they weren't doing that with these prisoners. So Michael took what seemed to be a hopeless case, and he lost. He went up to the Court of Appeals, and he lost. He went up to the Supreme Court, and they won. And he, along with a team of 600 lawyers that he had organized to defend the Bill of Rights, went on to litigate those cases, and they eventually freed. He forced Bush to free over 500 of these prisoners, and they stopped Bush from torturing these men. So I think that that amongst the many, many great cases that Michael handled or initiated, that was probably the foremost case. But we can talk about some other ones if you'd like.
I just want to pull from another section of the book, the Authorization to Use Military Force Act. Michael writes, gave the president such unprecedented, disturbing, and broad power that I was not just concerned but truly stunned. It essentially said the president can use military force to attack any country, organization, or person who aided, assisted, or harbored persons in the September 11th attacks, and that he could use that military force to prevent any further attacks. He could start wars against all 37 countries where the U.S. government claims the Al-Qaeda network is present, or against anyone else he suspects of involvement in the attacks of 9/11 or any future attacks. The president could do all this without getting any further approval from Congress, even if he leads us into World War III. So legally and politically, with the Authorization to Use Military Force Act, Congress gave up its authority over war and handed it to one individual in the White House. There was no time limit. They even gave the president a fat $20 billion check to help him along in this endless war. This is not what the framers of our Constitution imagined. On the contrary, the Constitution was drafted to keep presidential wars in check. As I read the details of the Authorization to Use Military Force Act, I could just see the excesses coming: illegal surveillance, indefinite detentions, torture, all in the name of national security. He was, one of the things about Michael is that his antenna was so acute that he instantly saw which way the winds were blowing. And of course, the famous case is Julian Assange, that he realized after the release of the Iraqi war logs, long before Julian or anyone around him did, that the U.S. state was coming for him.
Absolutely. We used to record our radio show in Michael's basement, and he had an encrypted phone at his desk. And very often, Julian Assange would call on that encrypted phone. Michael and Julian would talk almost daily, and he'd go over to London about every month, because he knew that if they were able to get Julian Assange for essentially telling the truth, Julian Assange never published anything that was inaccurate. He acted as a journalist and as a publisher. He received information. He encouraged people to give him information. He took that information. He distributed that information. That's what journalists and publishers do. The Times took it, El Pais took it, the German papers, the French papers. And the American imperial system was so embarrassed by what Julian Assange was revealing that they decided to get him. I'm not being conspiratorial here. We have a document from the State Department that says just that. They influenced the Swedes to make a false allegation that he was guilty of rape. They destroyed his character. He fled back to London. Michael had advised him, don't go to Sweden to answer these false charges because the Swedes will send you over to the United States and they'll lock you up forever.
I want to talk about this quote that you used in the foreword of Michael's book, Moving the Bar, about, I think it's from Lenin, about being as radical as reality itself. Explain what that means and why it was important as a kind of grounding for Michael.
Well, I think that all of us had to go through a process of learning actually what reality is, because there's an ideological system in this country. Marx said that the ideology of the ruling class is the ruling ideology. And we have an ideological system, the educational system, the communication system, and so on, that prevents us from really understanding in a radical way the roots of what's going on here. And Michael eventually, as we talked about, by 1968 came to understand that reality. And he reacted in a way that reflected that understanding. So he became as radical as reality itself.
And by that, he meant that he understood, what was taking place behind the veil, the crimes of empire. He was involved against the endemic racism within the United States. that when you looked at the actual machinery of power, the human suffering that it caused both at home and abroad was so radical that it demanded a radical response.
Yeah, precisely. Michael was not enamored of either one of the major political parties. He believed that social change came from below. He very much admired Howard Zinn, whose histories describe that. And his whole strategy in the cases that he took was to facilitate that social change from below. He would take cases that he knew he wouldn't win, but it could expose in a radical way the system that was oppressing people. On the Guantanamo cases, David Cole, who's now the director of the litigation for the American Civil Liberties Union, David asked him, why'd you take this case? And Michael said, 100% on principle.
And just to close, he always argued that activism was vital to judicial progress. Why?
Unless the system is shaken up, unless there are people in motion demanding democratic change, economic change, demanding more freedom, it's not going to happen. They're not going to give it to us. It's what Frederick Douglass said, of course, power concedes nothing without a demand. It never did, it never will. And Michael was using his skills as a lawyer to agitate and organize and facilitate those demands percolating up from below that would eventually change the law.
That was Chris Hedges interviewing me for On Contact.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Well, I'm walking down the highway with my suitcase in my hand. Yes, I'm walking down the highway with my suitcase in my hand. Lord, I really miss my baby. She's in some far land. Well, your streets are getting empty. Lord, your highway's getting filled. And your streets are getting empty, and your highway's getting filled.
Attorney Eleanor Stein, a professor at Albany Law School, Eleanor got to know Michael at Columbia Law School in the late spring of 1968. She was one of the five law students who joined many others at Columbia who barricaded themselves and occupied a building there. Michael returned to the campus just as a New York City police raid violently cleared the building and arrested hundreds of people. They bonded over the defense of another law student, Gus Reichbach, whom the law school attempted to punish. After years as a civil rights and anti-war activist, Eleanor went on to practice environmental and climate justice law as a teacher and an advocate. She has taught climate change and climate justice law since 2005. Attorney Eleanor Stein, welcome to the special edition about Michael Ratner on Law and Disorder Radio.
Happy to be here.
Eleanor, you and Michael were at Columbia Law School together in that historically momentous year of 1968. I'm thinking about the late spring of 68. The students took over several of the buildings, barricaded themselves in. You were in one of those barricade buildings. Michael arrived on campus, got himself beat up. Take the story from there and how you got to get to be such close friends and work with Michael.
Great. Yes, I remember it vividly. And I know those days were an important part of Michael's formative years. And, you know, he had come to Columbia as an avid student, a brilliant student, the son of a privileged family. And by the time he left, he got a very different education, I think, than the one his family expected him to get at Columbia. In fact, different than he expected to get. So it's important to look at the context a little bit. 1968, a year of unparalleled revolution. The French workers had liberated the factories, a general strike. Mexican students were on strike, Japanese students, German students. And it was also the year when over 500,000 American military personnel were serving in Vietnam, and more than 14,000 Americans were killed in combat. And based on that figure, I'd say several hundred thousand Vietnamese were also killed in that year. So we became consumed by the human cost of this war and the absolute urgency of throwing ourselves at and into the military machine to stop it, and also our responsibility as Americans for what our government was doing was just wrenching us apart. And the other thing that was happening, of course, simultaneously was uprisings in African-American communities a couple of weeks before the student takeover of the building at Columbia. Martin Luther King was assassinated in Memphis. And, of course, more than 100 cities across the country, people were in the streets, were met with tanks all over, including Washington, D.C. We're all remembering those days as we're living through the days of the movement for Black Lives and huge demonstrations that we have seen in the past year. So Michael got there while the students were in the buildings. He was there standing outside when the police took back the campus, arrested over 1,000 students, and he was pushed to the ground. He was injured. And all around him, he saw students being beaten by the police. And I think that that experience, just that moment, really was a revelatory moment for him. The law and his life in the law and his life, the life he had been groomed for by his family, were going to be changing profoundly. And he went on to dedicate his legal work to defending the most vulnerable, soon to international work, to working wherever the U.S. government was oppressing and subjugating people, overthrowing governments, jailing dissidents, stealing resources. And he became one of the great defenders of people around the world and was looked to by them. And I think that, to me, I see three threads that ran through the Columbia days and that really became central to the fabric of his entire life and work. I'd say, first, the fight against racism, which was a key demand at Columbia, to stop the building of a gym for students in one of Harlem's only parks. His resistance to U.S. military domination in the Third World. There was a Defense Research Analysis Institution on campus that was later ejected because of the struggles of the students. And maybe most fundamentally, his realization and determination to cast off his own privilege and throw his lot in with those who are fighting against their subjugation by our own government. So I see those as three red threads that really carried through for the rest of his life and underlay a lot of his work. You know, he was one of the greatest fighters of our generation, and I'm so glad that we get a chance to honor him and hold him up today, thanks to your work. You know, Michael was an important part of my life for almost half a century, and I miss him terribly. He was the most generous friend you could imagine. I once had to ask him for $100 for a mutual friend, a comrade who was in trouble and needed help, but was afraid to ask. And Michael gave me the money. And I said, Michael, how do you decide who to give money to? And he said, I give it to whoever asks.
Yes. Yes. That was something he told me too. I asked him that, and that was his answer. And I never forgot it.
Yeah. And the other thing is, I think he, in terms of his work as a lawyer, he came to stand for bringing, first of all, a level of fight, a level of militancy, a level of uncompromising defense of those who had been subject to the government that became a real standard. It really became a gold standard. And also his belief that you should use the law as a weapon, as a tool to fight the government, regardless of how you see the likelihood of success. And that, as he once said, he brought cases like the Guantanamo cases 100% on principle. And that clear, uncompromising integrity moved people all around him and everyone who knew of him or read of him or watched his work.
That was Eleanor Stein, a friend of Michael's, talking about Michael at law school. Attorney Richard Levy was a close friend of Michael Ratner's from the late 60s when they were active together in the National Lawyers Guild and in social movements of the time against the Vietnam War, U.S. intervention in Central America, apartheid in South Africa, and racism in the USA. Richard was the founder of a labor and civil rights firm which bears his name. He and Michael litigated a number of interesting lawsuits together from 1971 until Michael's death in 2016, including draft cases, human rights cases, and class actions against racial discrimination. Richard Levy, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Richard, you and Michael Ratner litigated a number of important, significant legal cases together over many years, and I wanted to ask you about several of them to kind of illustrate what it was like working with Michael. You had a case with the leader of the Puerto Rican Socialist Party who was drafted into the Army, and I wanted to ask you about that.
Well, that was a very interesting case and really sort of highlighted Michael's creativity and his broad knowledge. I mean, this was a case that was could have been a run-of-the-mill draft case. But two things happened that were very interesting about it, one of which was that this individual was a Puerto Rican national. He was born in Puerto Rico, and he was a leader, one of the leaders of the PSAP, the Socialist Party, Puerto Rican Socialist Party in New York. And Michael was very, very involved in the whole anti-colonialist movement, and particularly regarding Puerto Rico. So when this guy, Jose, showed up at Whitehall Street, he refused the draft, but he not only refused the draft on the steps of Whitehall Street, the induction center, but he had 1,000 or so of his comrades come, and it was a grand demonstration. So when he was arrested, as he obviously would be, one of the claims that Michael raised, and I raised with him, was that this was a selective prosecution, which was kind of funny, right? Selective prosecution meaning that they picked someone out, for some improper reasons. And this guy, of course, had stepped up and really asked himself virtually to be arrested to demonstrate his opposition to the Vietnam War. So we raised this selective prosecution claim in federal court, and we got a hearing out of it, and we dragged the case on. And also, because of the acute interest in the colonial issue in Puerto Rico, we raised a host of issues that Michael really, really came up with, because he was versed not only in U.S. law, but in international law. He was very well versed in international law. And so we challenged the prosecution on the grounds of violations of the Geneva Accords, which said you couldn't draft nationals of an occupied territory, which we regarded Puerto Rico as at the time. We raised claims of violations of the UN Charter and the U.S. Constitution and so on. But the breadth of the challenge was unique, and the case, of course, was pushed into so many complicated issues, including having the head of the Puerto Rican Socialist Party in Puerto Rico, Juan Mari Braz, come up and give an affidavit about the whole colonial nature of the occupation of Puerto Rico by the United States. It was a fabulous case, and the reason Michael did all those things was not because they were winnable claims. He did them because they highlighted the important social issues that the party was raising, that all these individuals who were fighting at that time very boldly for independence for Puerto Rico, these issues exemplified the claims that they were making about the interference of the U.S. government on that island. And so, you know, that really became the importance of the case, much more than the individual question of a draft dodger. But that was Michael. You know, that was Michael's, the breadth of his knowledge and the creativity. Just, he was remarkable that way, and of course, very brilliant.
I remember a meeting with Michael and you and several other people in your office years ago about the Manila Cemetery case, another case of colonialism. Tell our listeners about that cemetery case, please, and what happened in Israel.
Yeah, again, it was more than a symbolic case, really, although the symbolism was so deep. There was a very ancient cemetery in West Jerusalem, and it dated back probably to the 700s, but certainly it interred there were officials and officers and soldiers of the army of the Muslim leader Saladin. Since that time, which was in the 12th century, numbers of very, very prominent Muslim leaders in Palestine were interred in that cemetery. And the Israelis decided to allow the Wiesenthal Center to tear up that cemetery to build, ironically, a museum of tolerance on the site. Would have been laughable if it wasn't such a desecration of the cultural values of so many people who lived in that land and had so many ancestors who were buried at that site. So we prepared with Palestine Legal, with the assistance of Michael and the scholar Rashid Khalidi from Columbia University, a petition to the International Rapporteur for Palestine. And we challenged what was happening there, which was so devastating to people who cared about their culture and their religion and their history. We challenged this at UNESCO. We challenged it under the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And again, we were unable to prevail, but it was a way to highlight the kinds of terrible things that Israel was doing to erase the memory and the history of the Palestinian people in that land.
I wanted to ask you about a number of anti-racism cases that you were involved with Michael, and that's the firefighter case where New York City was discriminating against anybody but a white person getting a job as a firefighter. Can you talk about that, please?
Yeah, that was an outrageous situation that Michael brought us into. I did a lot of class action cases with him, and this was one of them. When he brought the case to me, 2-point-something percent of the firefighters in New York City were black. And the city was about 25% black at that time. And you have to know that the firefighting job is a very, very highly regarded and sought-after job. It's very well-paying. It has terrific benefits. And the guys who are in that job love it, absolutely love it. In fact, nationally, it's rated as one of the most satisfying jobs when they ask people, you know, how they feel about their work. Anyway, we brought a very broadly based class action against the New York City Fire Department. We had a very, very prejudicial exam thrown out and a number of very substantial obstacles to hiring knocked out along the way. And in addition, $100 million in damages were paid to applicants who over the previous years have been denied a fair opportunity to vie for those jobs because there was so much discrimination going on in the application. But again, it was Michael picking up on issues where groups were involved. This was the Vulcan Society, as well as the black community generally, but the Vulcan Society was a very old organization made up of a very small number of firefighters actually who made it into the department. But again, it was a community issue of great importance, I think, to the people of New York. I want to say one other thing about Michael Ratner, if I can. I'll take just a minute and say that for a guy with such brilliance and such creativity and such prominence in so many ways, he was such a sweetheart. He was such a modest, self-effacing guy, person. You know, an absolutely great lawyer, but never took himself so seriously. He took his issues tremendously seriously and the politics of the time and the people he was involved with, but not himself. And he was just a lovely, lovely man. He was a mentor to my children. And I guess people will talk about the other side of him, which was he had a tremendous sense of humor, and he was hilariously funny and very silly when he wanted to be. So working with him over close to 50 years was probably the highlight of my own legal career.
Richard Levy, thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder. And we look forward to getting your comments once you've had a chance to read Michael's book, Moving the Bar. You take it easy, Richard. Thank you again.
My pleasure, Michael.
That was Richard Levy talking about the cases that he and Michael Ratner litigated together.
We're going to speak with attorney David Cole, who started out as a young man at the Center for Constitutional Rights. He was a staff attorney there. He worked with Michael Ratner. He then went on to be a professor at Georgetown University Law Center. He's written 8 books. He's argued 3 cases before the Supreme Court. David Cole is presently the National Litigation Director at the American Civil Liberties Union. David Cole, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me.
David, let's talk about Michael Ratner's legacy. He's known most significantly for the Rasul versus Bush case. Could you please talk about that?
Well, Michael, I mean, I have to start by saying the last time I was on this show, Michael was one of the co-hosts. So it's a bittersweet to be doing this, but totally appropriate that you're celebrating him and his and the publication of his memoir. You know, Michael's legacy is really much broader than Rasul versus Bush. That was the case, the first case challenging the detention of enemy combatants at Guantanamo, Cuba, at a time when pretty much everybody, myself included, thought it was hopeless to bring such a case. And indeed, Michael thought it was hopeless to bring such a case, but nonetheless felt like it was important to do as a matter of principle. He was really the motivating force behind the filing of the first lawsuit challenging that detention at Guantanamo Bay. And, you know, they lost in the district court. They lost in the Court of Appeals unanimously. Lo and behold, they prevailed in the Supreme Court of the United States, to the surprise of, you know, I think everybody. What that did was it brought lawyers and judicial oversight to Guantanamo Bay and created for the first time real pressure on the Bush administration to clean up its act and in fact to release many of the people at Guantanamo. When Guantanamo at its height had 775 people detained there, but by the time Bush had left office, he had ordered the release of over 500 of those detainees. None of that would have happened without Rasul versus Bush.
David Cole, suing powerful people was something that Michael did often. He sued Ronald Reagan, Bill Clinton, Bush Sr. He took on generals. He used the Alien Tort Statute. Could you reflect on that, please?
I think he was always someone who was, number one, out for the underdog, and number two, skeptical of power and its abuse, and number three, committed to seeking to challenge the abuse of power, whether it was, you know, an abuse by Ronald Reagan in funding the Contras in Nicaragua, or whether it was Clinton in authorizing a war without congressional authorization, or whether it was suing foreign dictators under the Alien Tort Claims Act. Michael was willing to bring these suits, again, in many instances, without much hope of prevailing, but with an eye towards the critical importance of standing up to power and of bringing attention to bear on the violations, so that if the courts didn't do anything about it, maybe the political process would. I don't think Michael, you know, sort of, I don't think he sort of had some, I know he did not have some view that the courts will save us, but he saw the courts as part of a system that was designed to constrain power, but would only do that if people step up, take initiative, and use the levers that the system provides to do, you know, the unthinkable, to challenge the most powerful, and to bring attention to their wrongdoings.
Could you talk about Michael's inspiring young lawyers, please?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think in many respects that is really Michael's living legacy, are the probably hundreds of lawyers who came to be excited by the law and by the possibility of using the law to advance justice by working with Michael. Probably the biggest single case that had that effect was a case he handled when he was at the Center for Constitutional Rights, but also teaching at Yale Law School, teaching a clinic, a human rights clinic, along with Harold Coe, a professor there. And this was a time when Haitian refugees were being picked up on the seas and being brought to Guantanamo, long before Guantanamo was a place for for enemy combatants. It was a holding place for Haitian refugees because the government didn't want to bring the Haitian refugees, who they essentially rescued, on the high seas, didn't want to bring them to the United States because if they were worried that if they brought them to the United States, they'd get some rights protections that they wouldn't otherwise have, and it would be harder to sort of get them back to Haiti. And so they brought them to Guantanamo, and Michael and Harold and about 100 students at Yale Law School ultimately worked on a case that established that, in fact, the courts do have jurisdiction over what goes on at Guantanamo, even though it's not on U.S. soil, it's on Cuban soil formally, and ultimately led to the release of many of the people on that island. So the students at Yale Law School who worked with Michael on that case are a who's who of civil rights, civil liberties, and human rights lawyers today in the federal government, in NGOs, doing defender work, doing impact litigation. And, I think if you talk to almost any of them, they will say, that it was that experience that really transformed them in their views of what you could do with law and what you should do with law. And I know that personally because that was true for me. I came to the Center for Constitutional Rights in the summer of 1982 as a young law student. I had come to the center with the hopes of working on women's rights work with a lawyer named Rhonda Copeland, who had come to Yale Law School and had talked about some of her work. And I was very taken by the work that she was doing. And so I applied to work there over the summer. I got a job to work there over the summer. In between the time that I got that job and I showed up for my first day of work, Rhonda left the Center for Constitutional Rights and became a professor at CUNY Law School. She now too has passed away, sadly, but she was a fantastic lawyer and fantastic professor. There were no women's rights lawyers at the ACLU at that time in Rhonda's absence. They hadn't yet selected someone to take her place. And so it fell to me to work with this guy named Michael Ratner on cases challenging U.S. intervention in Central America, a whole bunch of cases challenging U.S. intervention in Central America. And it wasn't something I was particularly interested in. I was interested in women's rights. But I agreed to do it because there wasn't anything else to do. And it was the best move I ever made. Michael was such a fantastic person to work with because he was totally engaged in the work, had incredible ideas for lawsuits. He thought up the Guantanamo lawsuits, both the Haitian case and the case involving the detainees at Guantanamo in the war on terror. But he also had this absence of kind of ego and control that would allow him to allow those who worked with him to really take a lot of responsibility. So he brought me into cases and then didn't just have me, read deposition transcripts and do some research and summarize this and summarize that, but he would have me, write this section of the brief and ultimately write the briefs and argue the cases. And even though they were cases that he thought up, that they were really his brainchild, he was willing to have other people stand up and take the credit. And as a mentor, that's just an incredible gift because it means that, when you're a mentee, you are being given not only guidance, but also the opportunity to step up and to take action. And, I ultimately, I clerked for a year, but I went back to the center because of Michael. When I went back to the center, he was actually going on a sabbatical. They had sabbaticals in those days for at the Center for Constitutional Rights, and he said he's going to be off for 4 to 6 months. I can't remember. And he said to me, David, here's my entire docket. Take my docket. You can have my cases. Do them while I'm on sabbatical. And of course, knowing Michael, he didn't go anywhere on the sabbatical. He was right there. He was still totally involved. Whenever I had a question, whenever I had a brief to write, he would review it. He would engage with me. But he just gave the cases to me. There are very few lawyers in this country that would do something like that. And I thank Michael for my entire career. I've now been a lawyer for 40 years, and I wouldn't have been the kind of lawyer I am without him.
David Cole, thank you so much for your remembrance of Michael Ratner, and every success to you with your constitutional litigation.
Well, thank you, and thank you, Michael, for picking up and finishing off Michael's memoir when he was unable to finish at the very end of his life there, because it's really a story that needs to be told and that deserves to be read widely.
Oh, Michael, it's so wonderful to hear all those voices and to think back of our time with Michael Ratner and everything that he did to advance the community of people's lawyering.
Yes, it certainly was. And the book that Michael produced with Zach Sklar's help, Moving the Bar, My Life as a Radical Lawyer, is just a joy to read. You can get it at orbooks.com. That's orbooks.com. If you go to that website, you can order the book and they'll send you a copy. Enjoy it as we have.